This week, Russia's galvanizing opposition leader and fierce President Vladimir Putin critic Alexei Navalny has died in an Arctic penal colony.
The fixation and fear of one man only underscores the weakness and rot at the heart of the system that Putin has built. Russia's responsible for this. We'll be talking to many other countries concerned about Alexei Navalny.
Ukraine's growing struggle to fend off invading Russian forces without military aid.
Ukraine is fighting our fight, and if we let Ukraine falter, then that fight comes to our front door.
And doctors at a southern Gaza hospital describe the scene inside after Israeli forces searching for Hamas militants raid the facility. Join us on The Voice of America as we explore the issues in the news. Hello, I am Rick Pantaleo in Washington. Russian President Vladimir Putin and his associates will not go unpunished if the death of Alexei Navalny, as reported by Russian prison officials, turns out to be true. A tearful but defiant Yulia Navalnaya, the wife of Navalny, addressing world leaders at the annual Munich Security Conference Friday following Russian reports that he had died in prison, called upon the international community to come together and fight against the, quote, horrific regime in Russia. Her husband, the most outspoken and fierce critic of Vladimir Putin, died in an Arctic penal colony where he was serving a 19-year sentence on charges of extremism.
He bravely stood up to the corruption, the violence, all the bad things that Putin government was doing. In response, Putin had him poisoned, he had him arrested, he had him prosecuted for fabricated crimes, he sentenced him to prison, he was held in isolation. Even all that didn't stop him from calling out Putin's lies.
U.S. President Joe Biden, speaking at the White House, said he is not surprised and outraged by the news of Navalny's death.
But make no mistake, Putin is responsible for Navalny's death. Putin is responsible.
Biden also said Navalny's death brings new urgency for the need for Congress to approve tens of billions of dollars in aid for Ukraine.
This tragedy reminds us of the stakes of this moment. We have to provide the funding so Ukraine can keep defending itself against Putin's vicious onslaughts and war crimes.
For deeper insights into Ukraine's challenges as Russia's invasion approaches the two-year mark and the significance of Alexei Navalny's death, VOA's Lori London got reaction from Jim Thompson with the Center for a New America's Security's Transatlantic Security Program and former Deputy Assistant Director of Defense for European and NATO Policy.
My reaction is that if there is anyone who has any doubts about who we're dealing with in the form of Putin, this should take away that doubt. We're dealing with someone who is a very dangerous man and someone who, when he talks about taking other countries like Ukraine or doing further aggressive acts against the West or the United States, we need to take him at face value. This guy is a killer, as I think it was President Biden once said, and this is proving it. And so if there are people, whether it's in the United States or in Europe, who think that this problem with Putin can be sorted out with talks around a table, or this is going to, you know, this will pass and we'll muddle through, etc., they need to understand, and this will help them understand, that we're entering into a period of potential conflict, and we've got to get ready for that and not think that this is just going to be a crisis that will disappear one day.
World leaders are actually responding as they meet in Munich at the Munich Security Conference, and U.S. leaders, including Vice President Kamala Harris, are also working to assure allies U.S. support is unwavering. That, of course, following former President Trump's comments this past week regarding pulling out of NATO. How significant is it that they're doing this much damage control and European leaders are literally working on the possibility of the U.S. no longer being in NATO?
Well, I think it's fine for the vice president and other U.S. leaders to be reassuring allies, but we need to get past the rhetoric here. How many times over the past 2 years have we had to go out and reassure, whether it was because of something Trump said or something that has happened in the U.S. Congress, like in the House of Representatives, in terms of our commitment to Ukraine that now seems to be quite wobbly. And so there is also a tone, I think, that needs to be different coming from the administration. That's got to be one of preparing the American people for the idea that we could be in a conflict in the next few years. European leaders are doing that already. The Danes are, the Swedes are, the Finns are, the Germans are, the UK is. Just five off the top of my head who are telling their people that the intelligence that we're beginning to put together about Russia is one that they seem to be contemplating a further act of aggression after Ukraine. And so while we can sit there and reassure about the commitment, et cetera, I think we need to have a tone that says, not only are we reassuring you, but we want to show you all the things that we're getting ready to do ourselves in terms of getting stronger as a U.S. military and beefing up the U.S. force posture in Europe. And so at Munich, I think certainly we can reassure and say, yes, don't worry, we're there. But I think we've also got to start talking tough about what we're doing to prepare ourselves. And I don't hear that. I hear a lot of just rhetoric that I've heard before about how we love our allies. But what are we doing to lead the allies in terms of making up for a lot of lost time on strengthening our militaries? I know we are behind the scenes, quietly, and the allies are too, but we've got to move faster. And to move faster, there needs to be some political pressure. And so we need to start talking about that. And so I would rather hear that, or at least that in addition to reassurance, I want to hear some tougher talk out of the administration about getting the alliance ready and allies getting ready for potential conflict.
What do you anticipate if there were one? What would that look like? Are you saying Russia invading yet a NATO ally?
Well, that's right. I think there was an intelligence report coming out of Estonia saying that a Russian move to embarrass the alliance in a couple of years when the allies were not quite ready to deal with a recapitalized Russian military. A Russian military that's been over the course of this year and next year is going to try to get stronger just to finish the job as they see it in Ukraine. And so you find yourself in a few years from now with a larger Russian military, learning a lot of lessons from Ukraine, turning to a smaller NATO ally like one of the Balts, and making a move and just to test the alliance to see if we would respond or not. If Putin has the idea that the United States is not as committed to NATO as we might have been in the past, that the European allies are not as strong, or certainly they don't have the political will to cross swords with the Russians, if that's the impression that Putin has, and in a couple of years he's got a stronger military than he has today, and he wants to test that theory, he pushes and bullies one of the allies and to see what kind of response comes from the United States and from Europe. And if he senses weakness, that the response will be less than what it would have been in years past, then he might, in fact, take a piece of the alliance and have a showdown with us. That's the fear. There's intelligence that seems to be coming in that says that kind of thing is being contemplated in the Kremlin. And we know that the Russians are recapitalizing their military. They're on a war footing right now, reconstituted their defense industry. So this is not something that's being made up out of whole cloth. So it would look something along those lines. But we have to deter that. And to deter that kind of aggression, we have to get stronger, and we have to do it more quickly than we're doing now.
With U.S. military aid now in serious doubt, how long can Ukraine hold out? Will Ukraine survive?
No. If the U.S. ceases its assistance to Ukraine and there's not the funding there and the U.S. military assistance there, the Europeans at this stage can't fill that gap. And if the Russians are continuing to get bigger and stronger, I mean, they have an offensive going on right now all along the line in Ukraine. Ukraine is barely able to hold them back now. So if the U.S. falters here and doesn't provide the assistance or provides it a year from now instead of now, no, it's a mathematical thing. Ukraine will fight like hell, that's for sure. But in terms of just the difference in population and the difference in military and, you know, defense, Ukraine is at a disadvantage. So the answer to your question is the Ukraine will falter if the U.S. is not in there right now, strongly providing ammunition and funding and other things that are needed to keep them fighting. They've got the fighting spirit in Ukraine. They need the weapons. And that's where we come in. And if we don't provide it, then we'll be facing Russia on the NATO border. Ukraine is fighting our fight. And if we let Ukraine falter, then that fight comes to our front door.
Jim Thompson with the Center for a New American Security's Transatlantic Security Program. listening to Issues in the News. I'm Rick Pantaleo. Israeli special forces entered the main hospital in southern Gaza on Thursday in what the army said was a limited operation. Israeli troops, tanks, and snipers have surrounded the hospital compound for at least a week, with heavy fire all around it. Israel's chief military spokesman, Rear Admiral Daniel Hagari.
We have credible intelligence from a number of sources, including from released hostages, indicating that Hamas held hostages at the Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis, and that there may be bodies of our hostages in the Nasser Hospital facility.
Health officials Friday reported 5 patients in intensive care died after their oxygen ran out.
A key objective, as defined by our military mission, is to ensure that the Nasser Hospital continues its important functions of treating Gazan patients.
Israel accuses Hamas of using hospitals and other civilian structures to shield its fighters. With no end in sight to the conflict, VOA's Lori London caught up with Jamil Jaffer, founder and executive director of the National Security Institute, who is attending the Munich Security Conference, first asking for a reaction to the death of Putin critic Alexei Navalny.
Well, Lori, it certainly seems like Alexei Navalny appears to have been killed by Vladimir Putin. This idea that a 47-year-old who was in otherwise good health, at least before he was transferred to this prison in the Arctic a few months back, has now walked around and fallen sick and died seems unlikely. What it seems much more like is the attempted poisoning in 2020 of Alexei Navalny with Novichok, which also presents itself as somebody appearing unwell and health conditions. So I think what we're seeing here is yet another attempt by Vladimir Putin to take out and silence permanently his fiercest critics. We saw this happen with a former colleague of his, a close friend, a general who commanded some outside forces for him, who was ultimately taken out in a mysterious plane crash after he marched to Moscow. Alexei Navalny, now jailed for a couple of years outside of Moscow, moved to this Arctic prison and now also dying a suspicious death. It just once again demonstrates the brutality of the Putin regime and demonstrates that all these claims that we just saw in this Tucker Carlson interview from last week of Putin sort of looking out for Russia and being in general a man of peace are all just false claims.
The summit obviously is going to be dominated by Russia's invasion of Ukraine, but also Israel's war in Gaza, the latest ceasefire, hostage release negotiations ended this week in another stalemate. Where do you see this going? And Gaza's getting pummeled, but is it achieving its goal of eradicating Hamas, given that some of the leaders aren't actually even in Gaza?
Well, look, I think there's two things to be said. First, on Ukraine, you're right, it is dominating the conversation. It is primarily what folks are talking about here in Munich. But there is a consensus here. And the consensus view, increasingly so, is Russia has to be stopped. And there's increased concern that the United States isn't going to do its part to help stop Russia and that Europe may need to step up and do more. The reality is that without U.S. support, sustained U.S. support, and frankly, more U.S. support than even what's being asked for right now, that's what's necessary to win this fight and for the Ukrainians to win. We need to not only help the Ukrainians fight to a stalemate, but to actually win. The White House hasn't done that thus far, and Congress certainly hasn't backed even the White House's effort to keep this war where it is at a stalemate. So that's a huge problem, and one I think that you're right will dominate the conference's agenda. Beyond that, on this question of the war against Hamas, there's no doubt that there's been success in this fight by Israel against Hamas. Significant portions of their fighting force has been taken out. You're right that significant parts of their leadership are in other places, including in Qatar, where that needs to be addressed. But beyond that, look, Israel's made clear from the beginning of this fight that they will not end the war in Gaza until Hamas is destroyed or, frankly, gives up the fight, which they are not currently willing to do. And so as a result, I don't think you're going to see any ceasefire that's going to take place, long-term ceasefire, until Hamas agrees to release all the hostages and agrees to tamp down its attacks. What we saw what happened in Israel, essentially the equivalent of a dozen 9/11s, you remember the way the U.S. reacted to 9/11 with the 3,000 deaths and the 20-year war we fought. And so the idea that somehow this fight with Hamas is going to end in a couple of few months, even with the horrific number of civilian casualties, I think that's highly unlikely, and nobody should expect that.
But tensions between the Netanyahu government and many Western countries, including the U.S., are growing. President Biden recently said Israel's response has been over the top. Will the U.S. ultimately take some of the blame for continuing to supply weapons?
Well, I don't think this is about blame. I mean, you remember how our allies stood by us in the aftermath of 9/11. NATO invoked Article 5. They fought alongside us for 20 years in Afghanistan as we sought to take down al-Qaeda around the globe, not just in Afghanistan, but in various locations around the globe. And so the idea that Israel should simply put its weapons down and stop the fight now while Hamas is still out there and still calling for the destruction of Israel, I think is unlikely to happen. And frankly, Israel's allies need to stand by Israel in this time of conflict. That being said, could more to be done to protect civilians? Of course. And I think, frankly, to be honest with you, Lori, the Israelis have every incentive to try and not kill civilians. Why? For every Palestinian woman or child or civilian that dies, Israel's ability to prosecute its war against Hamas is decreased. By the same token, for every Palestinian woman or child or civilian that dies, Hamas is empowered because they gain sympathy from the world, including in the West. And so this idea somehow that Israel is intending to kill civilians or wants to kill civilians or is unaware of the impact that the loss of civilian life has, they are painfully aware of it. And so I don't doubt they're going to continue to try and do everything they can to avoid civilian death. Could more be done? Absolutely. Should more be done? Absolutely. Are they fighting a war that they need to fight and win? Absolutely.
There is a very strong global public opinion about the more than 28,000 people, civilians, mostly women and children, that have been killed as a result. That's a lot of people.
It is a lot of people, and it's a horrific number. Even one civilian, woman, child that dies in this war is too many. But you have to ask yourself, Lori, why are civilians dying? Civilians are dying in this conflict because Hamas conducted an attack, the equivalent of a dozen 9/11s, and they hide their forces among civilian populations. They are violating the laws of war. They hide in hospitals. They hide in the middle of cities. They hide under schools. This is not about how Israel is prosecuting the war. This is about how Hamas, a long-listed American terrorist group in the United States since the 1990s, a terrorist group listed in the United States, behaves. And so everybody should be clear. If people are unhappy about Palestinian civilian lives, the place to point the finger is Hamas.
So how does this all end? And do you think the hostages that are still alive will ever be released and will survive?
Well, you know, Lori, the question of the hostages is a very difficult one, and what happens to them. We don't know how many are alive exactly, but I think that to the extent that Israel can get its hostages out, it will do what it takes to make trades to do that. Hamas knows that, and so they're looking to hold out as long as possible. They're trying to get as many Palestinian prisoners released as possible. I think Israel has demonstrated in the past, historically, that they will trade a significant number of Palestinian prisoners for Israeli hostages. So I think you'll see that continue forward. You'll also see probably brief pauses in the fighting and ceasefire in order to get those hostages out. But at the end of the day, the idea that Israel will end this fight, whether the fight's actually in Gaza itself or abroad, to go after these Hamas operatives after what happened in Israel on October 7th, I think is highly unlikely. Hamas leadership needs to understand that. Palestinian leadership in the West Bank needs to understand that as well. And frankly, world opinion needs to understand that and has to remember how we would feel here in the United States, in Europe, in the West, if the equivalent of a dozen 9/11s had happened in our country and what we would expect from our allies.
Jamil Jaffer, founder and executive director of the National Security Institute. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thanks, Lori.
The war between Israel and Hamas, now in its fifth month, has devastated hospitals in the Gaza Strip, with less than half of them only partially functioning as Israel's daily bombardments kill and wound scores of people. Israel accuses the militants of using hospitals and other civilian buildings as cover. Physician Tanya Haj Hassan with Doctors Without Borders spoke with VOA's Lori London and described what she is hearing from her medical colleagues on the ground in Gaza.
Catastrophic. I'm running out of words to describe how horrific it is. And I think they are too, my colleagues that I speak to. One of them actually sent this message. It's a senior doctor that was displaced to Rafah. He said, "We're suffering from destruction, killing, hunger, displacement, and the displacement of my children from one place to another inside Gaza. We appeal to you to remove us from this certain death. I ask you to help." And then he later said, "We're being subject to extermination." One of my colleagues at 2 a.m. sent this message saying, "Clashes, bombing, fire belts, a terrifying night in every sense of the word." This is all in Rafah. This is the safe zone where people were asked to evacuate to. So I think they're terrified. They are fearing for their lives, the lives of their families. Many of them have lost multiple family members already. And they're fearing for their colleagues that are still stuck inside Al-Nasser Hospital. So Nasser Hospital is a hospital in Khan Yunis that was besieged more than 20 days ago. There are about 300 staff, over 10,000 displaced people, all that were trapped in the compound. And it was encircled by Israeli troops that started shooting at the hospital. Healthcare professionals injured in the compound. And even one OR operating room nurse that was shot in the chest through the window of the hospital by Israeli forces. Many people were killed as they attempted to reach the hospital, injured. Other injured were lying in the vicinity of the hospital and could not be reached safely to be pulled into the hospital and treated. They'd started demolishing the northern wall. They burnt down the warehouses of the hospital, and they're not giving the staff a safe corridor to evacuate the patients from, and then also not a final destination. Where do you evacuate a bunch of critically ill or injured patients when you have destroyed the entire healthcare system of a population? This is in Khan Yunus. This is the Nasser Hospital. Meanwhile, you have a faucet that is a tap that is on full-blown open so that you just have this torrential flow of patients, and you've basically put a drain on it. So you just have all of these patients that are unable to receive clinical care and are going to die from that. The one thing that I would say many people don't understand when they think about what's happening in Gaza is people are being killed in two main ways. They're being killed through a fast, violent death, and we've seen pictures and images of people who've been dismembered, maimed. Those who've survived with debilitating amputations and brain injuries. And those who die very likely a fast and violent death. And then you have your slow deaths. It's all the people that are going to die as a consequence of not being able to receive treatment for their injuries or treatment for their diseases. It's all the people that are going to die of starvation, of hypothermia, of epidemics. And these, according to many humanitarian organizations, are going to outstrip the already horrific, unprecedented at numbers of those killed a fast and violent death. And I think that kind of fast death, slow death combination is something that people don't really appreciate. A lot of my colleagues who've survived, and I received messages to this effect from multiple, not just from one or two, have said, you know, we almost envy those who have died because they haven't suffered for the last 4 months like we have, as we've lost family member and colleague after another, as we've been starved, as we've seen things that you can never, ever unsee.
There are also those that are pregnant or about to give birth in the midst of this. What must that be like?
It's the difficulties of pregnancy and the stress of all of this on pregnancy, on both psychologically on the mother, physically on the mother. You know, mothers are starving and dehydrated and extremely stressed. And then the delivery itself. We know that there is very few places to safely deliver in Gaza right now. The main delivery hospital is completely overwhelmed. Mothers are being turned away during labor because there's just no space to take care of anything that's not an uncomplicated labor. One mother last month described being turned away from the hospital and eventually going and delivering in the latrine of her refugee camp, and the baby died. Another colleague of ours, actually a nurse, described a family member of hers who delivered at home successfully. Mom survived, baby survived the delivery. She's holding her baby, so relieved to have survived something so scary. You know, I'm not saying a home delivery with a midwife. This is a home delivery without any medical help in the middle of a war zone. And then 10 hours later, her home was bombed and both her and her 10-hour baby were killed. We have many other stories of pregnant women being killed, being brought to the hospital dead, and the doctors performing what's called a postmortem cesarean section to try and take the baby out to see if they can resuscitate the baby before it dies from lack of blood supply.
Where are people going to go if they're forced out of Rafah?
I don't think we should even be asking that question. People should not be forced out of Rafah, period. People should not be forced out of the north of Gaza or the middle of Gaza. All of these evacuations of people that are moving the entire population further and further south have resulted in an immense amount of both mortality and morbidity, both death and suffering. I think we need to stop trying to talk about what happens when they're displaced for the next time. They should not be displaced for a sixth time. This does not happen in the world. Just last month, the ICJ ruled on plausible genocide and put in place provisional measures to prevent it. And yet here we are, a couple weeks later, essentially violating every spirit of those provisional measures. Humanitarian aid not being let in, being obstructed, being denied. The majority of those denied were those delivering what needed to be done for water, sanitation, in health facilities, etc. Things that aren't dangerous to Israel, but if denied to the population, would result in extreme suffering to civilians and would continue to debilitate already debilitated healthcare system. I also, Lori, I can't get the images of hundreds of thousands of starving children out of my head, or the images of those children who are now mute because they have seen members of their family massacred in front of their eyes, and now they no longer speak. People are unable to speak from the horrors that they have seen, and us, thousands of kilometers away, are also like completely speechless, and we're not experiencing it. This is a massacre that is being live streamed. It's a moral failure. It's an utter moral failure.
Physician Tanya Haj Hassan with Doctors Without Borders. That's all the time we have this week. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thank you for listening. Join us next week for more issues in the news. Until then, I'm Rick Pantaleo.